The ocean and freshwater streams are very different places, but they share some space. Lots of it, in fact. Fresh and salt water meet in the estuary, a fascinating place with unique plant and animal life. Our first guest today studies estuaries extensively nearby and far away. Dr. David Sutherland is a coastal physical oceanographer. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Oregon. And he focuses on one estuary near us, Coos Bay. And he spends plenty of time in other estuaries and cold places where the effects of climate change can be seen up close. Dr. Sutherland speaks about the Coos Bay Estuary on Friday at 7 at Southwestern Oregon Community College. We get a preview right now. Dr. Sutherland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go with the big stuff first. What is an estuary and what makes these places so important?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Typically, people think about estuaries where a river meets the ocean. But I think there's one more key part that's it has to be sort of a semi-enclosed region so that you have some sort of trapping of that fresh water. And we can even expand that definition to include not just river water, but any fresh water that meets the ocean. And that way I can include all the stuff I do in Greenland and Antarctica and other places around the Arctic as estuaries as well. So it's wherever fresh water meets the ocean, and that induces a lot of really cool dynamic mixing and other things that we're trying to understand.
You know, given that we have some creatures that exist better in salt water and some in fresh water, there are those who travel between, like anadromous fish. But I mean, are there some creatures that thrive in the estuary above all other places?
Sure, there's lots of creatures that have a multi-part life cycle, actually, that take advantage of the estuary during one part of their life cycle and then move out to the salt water during another part and then come back to the estuary, say, to complete their life cycle. And estuaries provide a lot of good habitat. If you think about mudflats or seagrass beds, more sheltered areas that when certain organisms are young, they can use those habitats to their advantage and then move out maybe to the ocean where there's more productivity or other things that they might take advantage of when they're in other parts of their life cycle.
Is there a best example of a creature that makes the estuary its home in Coos Bay, for example?
Well, I think about Dungeness crab a lot. And in particular, I work with scientists at the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology down in Coos Bay in Charleston. And they spend a lot of time thinking about oyster larvae, crab larvae, and all sorts of invertebrates that take advantage of the estuary and then move out into the coastal ocean and then sometimes they try to recruit back into the estuary to complete their life cycle. And so I think crab is a really good example of that.
Is the Coos Bay Estuary the only one you study at a lower latitude?
I spent a lot of time studying Puget Sound, actually. After my graduate student years, I worked at University of Washington and studied Puget Sound, which is a fjord-type estuary to where Seattle is located. And it's multiple branches, very deep, very different compared to Coos Bay and some of the other Oregon estuaries that we have.
Well, I was going to ask you how different one estuary can be from another because, you know, to undrained eyes, it's like, well, you know, salt water, fresh water, bingo, estuary. But it sounds like conditions can vary greatly from place to place.
That's right. Yeah. And really, it's geometry is really important. So the fact that Puget Sound is, you know, sometimes 600 feet deep, whereas Coos Bay and other smaller Oregon estuaries are at most, you know, 30 to 40 feet deep. That plays a really big role. And then just the amount of fresh water that comes into a system really dictates the dynamics of that estuary. So the fact that, you know, the Columbia River estuary, for example, is very different than Coos Bay just because the discharge coming out of the Columbia is in order like 10 times bigger than the Coos River, say. So that those two factors, geometry and the amount of fresh water coming into the system, really tell us where those systems might lie in parameter space.
We're talking about estuaries here on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. David Sutherland, a coastal physical oceanographer from the University of Oregon. He'll be talking about Coos Bay's estuary Friday night at 7 at the Hales Center at Southwestern Oregon Community College. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions about life in the estuary and its significance. We're going to move off and talk about high-latitude estuaries as well. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to get a part of this conversation. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Is Coos Bay, then, is it fairly typical for an estuary, a coastal estuary in Oregon or in the Northwest or just generally at this latitude?
It's very typical of a Northwest estuary, especially outside of the Columbia River, I'd say, is the atypical one because it has such a big watershed that reaches pretty far inland. It has fresh water coming out most of the year because of snow melt and other things, whereas these estuaries like Coos Bay Yacuna Bay, Alsea Bay, all these small, you know, Oregon estuaries outside the Columbia are much more seasonal. Whereas, you know, in the summertime, our rain dries up, it's beautiful, blue skies, but the river discharge almost goes to zero, and that really affects the estuarine response. And in the wintertime, we get these big storm events, lots of rain and lots of wind, and that can really then make the estuary respond very fast. And so we get these sort of this dual nature of estuaries in the Northwest, where in the summertime, they're very well mixed, low discharge, low freshwater. In the wintertime, lots of rain, lots of wind, and you get the really freshwater-dominated estuary.
So the living conditions are very different then from one part of the year to the other. I mean, a very, very great difference in salinity alone, I would think.
That's right, yeah. So we can go from, you know, if you're a little animal or plant living in the estuary, you can certainly, you have to be ready to go from freshwater all the way up to full ocean salinity. So certain animals are certainly adapted to that, and they prefer to live maybe closer to the mouth of the estuary where there's more salt water, or they prefer to live more up estuary towards the river end where there's more typically fresher water. Barnacles are a good example of that. There's certain species of barnacles that like to live, you know, on either end of the estuary.
You mean some are happier in fresh water and some are happier in saltier water?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. How many different species of barnacles are there?
That's a good question. I know of, I'm sure there's actually tens or probably lots of species. I know there's two main ones in Coos Bay, and so one is very adaptable, and you can find them all over the estuary, and then there's the other species that is more freshwater adapted, so you find them more up estuary.
So what are some of the other characteristics of the Coos Bay estuary that might make it unique from others?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you know, if you ever looked at a map of the Coos Bay estuary, it's very sinuous, very complicated, sort of twisty, churny geometry, and that makes it a little bit unique. It's not like an estuary on the East Coast that's very straight, Drown River Valley. So the Coos River comes in on its eastern end, but there's all these sloughs and inlets that make it a really complicated estuary, especially to try to get measurements from all those different locations. It takes a big effort. As well as, you know, we try to make numerical models to try to understand the circulation, the currents in the estuary. And the fact that its geometry is so complicated makes it really difficult to do that. So that's one feature. The other feature that makes it unique, in Oregon at least, is that it's dredged. So it's dredged to a depth of about 42 feet. So it's a deep draft estuary. It's been you know, dubbed industrial in terms of Oregon's plan for estuaries. And so the fact that it's dredged deeper than its natural depth means that the circulation in the estuary is very different than say, a more natural estuary that would be much shallower.
So it's a changed estuary from what it would have been if left alone.
That's right, yeah. Humans have played a big impact in Coos Bay. And when we dredge, you know, the main channel, you have to put those spoils somewhere. And in the past, they put those spoils most times in the estuary itself. Nowadays, they put them offshore, but in the past, there's plenty of spoil islands and places where they've dumped spoils in Coos Bay. And that's just the dredging part. Obviously, there's been a lot of industry in Coos Bay as well that have impacted the environmental quality of the ecosystem.
Which raises the question about how resilient estuaries are. I mean, you've got tidal forces going on, but certainly human forces as well. You've got freshwater arriving. You've got whatever came down the streams into the estuary, whatever is being done in the bay, and in this case, an industrial bay, as you point out. So, I mean, the whole dilution is the solution to pollution thing. Does that really hold true, or are estuaries particularly sensitive to things that humans do?
Yeah, that's a good question. It certainly depends on where you are in the estuary about how diluted you can get. And, I mean, the good thing about estuaries is, or estuaries like Coos Bay, is that they can be actively flushed or replenished with ocean water that maybe, you know, whether or not you think the ocean water is changing, is becoming more polluted, that's a different question. But if you think about it as natural ocean water coming in and flushing the system, then Coos Bay does pretty well. It has a tidal flushing, flushes about 30% of the estuary's volume every tidal cycle, and then there's this thing that we call the estuarine exchange flow, which is a slower, more sort of like a week-long time scale of overturning that flushes out the estuary. And that's in the main channel. There's some, you know, some of the backwaters and some of the in the small sloughs and inlets, those are pretty stagnant, and anything that happens in those in terms of contamination or pollution could stick around. for a while.
Dr. David Sutherland, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a coastal physical oceanographer, assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Oregon. We're talking about estuaries with a particular focus on Coos Bay, which is what he'll be talking about at Southwestern Oregon Community College Friday night at 7. But we have him now, and he's also worked at other parts of the world. We'll get to that in just a moment. You can talk with us about estuaries and what goes on where the fresh water meets the salt. 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We touched briefly on Greenland, but you've worked in other high-latitude places apparently too, haven't you?
That's correct, yeah. So Greenland I started working on during my PhD, my graduate school, and then I've worked in Southeast Alaska and starting a new project actually in the Western Antarctic Peninsula. So touching both poles.
Over the time that you've been studying some of these places, have you seen changes that can be ascribed directly to climate change?
We've certainly seen very rapid changes in the ice sheets, in the glaciers that drain these ice sheets. In particular, I can give you one example in southeast Greenland. We were studying one glacier, and these glaciers are huge. We're talking a glacier that's 3 miles wide by half a mile deep, you know, entering the ocean. And around the rim of the glacier, above the water surface, you can see rock that's a different color than the rest of the rock, and it's about 100 meters, so 300 feet of this band of rock around the rim of the glacier. And that rim is sort of like the bathtub ring of where the glacier has thinned. So it's basically getting thinner and accelerating. And you can see just direct evidence, just visually, you can see where that glacier used to be only about 10, 15 years ago. And that's actually really remarkably fast change for a system like an ice sheet. You know, you think of glaciers moving slowly, right, glacial pace. But to see such changes happen in a decade is pretty remarkable.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and that's what, you know, has gotten everyone so excited, is maybe not the right word, nervous, anxious about what's happening in Greenland and in Antarctica.
Well, and then I noticed your team at the University of Oregon offers a download of a poster saying climate change is not a hoax. What's the what's the short version of the truth of it?
Everywhere we look, we see observations that climate is changing, and it's changing faster than what we can attribute to, say, it's changing faster and all in the same direction than what we can attribute to, say, natural variability. So everywhere we look in terms of ocean temperatures, sea ice area, land ice, you know, ocean acidification, permafrost, air temperature, every indicator we look at, they're all going in the direction that we would expect if you think of a human-impacted greenhouse gas emission scenarios.
So how frustrating is it as scientists to have political and other non-scientist figures criticize the work you put out there?
It's frustrating when politicians and policymakers don't look at the science for itself or look at the data, and they just politicize it based on their beliefs. I would say that's very frustrating. So I guess as a scientist, you want people to look at your data and your findings, you know, without any bias or without any subjectivity. And so it can be frustrating. And I think scientists, you know, on the flip side, scientists haven't done a very good job at communicating their science. You know, sometimes we sit back and expect people to just say, wow, look at their cool science, look at their data, they're doing really neat stuff. But I think we need to get out there and be a little more proactive and put our science in people's faces a little bit.
In a public sense? Or, I mean, what would be the good venues for that, do you think?
Yeah, in a public sense. You know, like I'm giving a lecture this Friday at SWOC, and that's one area. So just going out, giving public lectures, interacting more with local politicians on the local, state, and federal level. You know, as scientists, we sometimes think it's that will be seen as a sellout or someone who's politicizing their science if we even talk about it to non-scientists. So I think we need to get over that and just start. It doesn't mean we can't be objective and just, you know, show our science as it is. It just means we need to be just communicating it to the public a little bit.
Up to now, it's been seen as kind of showy and to go outside the academy.
Yeah,
like
sure. Mm-hmm. People, you know, trying to get publicity for their science, and there's that sort of, yeah. So getting over that and making it okay to be to engage with the public and with policymakers, I think, is something we need to work on as scientists.
We have a few minutes more here with Dr. David Sutherland from the University of Oregon. He's a coastal physical oceanographer. As he mentioned, he'll be speaking at 7 o'clock Friday night at SWOC, Southwestern Oregon Community College, at the Hale Center, talking about the estuary in Coos Bay and estuaries he studied in other parts of the world, including in Greenland and other high-latitude places. Take part in this discussion, 800-838-3760, with your questions and comments. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. I noticed in your work that you point out that the glacier and ocean interactions have not been a focus of study until recently. Why do you suppose that is?
A big part of that is that we didn't think the ocean could actually impact these glaciers and ice sheets. So in Greenland and Antarctica, the glaciers that drain the ice sheets often end in the ocean. We call them tidewater glaciers. There's good examples in Alaska, too, and people have probably seen YouTube videos of glaciers calving off massive icebergs into the ocean. And so these glaciers, end in the ocean. We've always thought of it as a one-way system, like the glaciers and ice sheets putting ice and fresh water into the ocean. But it turns out that changes in the ocean can actually impact the terminus of that glacier, so right where the ocean meets the ice. And in fact, if you can erode away the underside or the underbelly of that glacier, you might impact its overall dynamics. And so we're just getting to the point of making models and predictions of coupled dynamics of glacier, ice sheet, and ocean predictions.
Ocean levels aside, have you found anything out about changes in the ocean and in estuaries caused by increasing amounts of fresh water melting into them?
Yeah, so what can happen when you add fresh water into an estuary in Coos Bay or in Greenland or in Greenland Fjord, that fresh water typically is lighter, less dense than the ocean water, and so it typically rides, it'll go up to the surface, and it can actually increase what we call how stratified the ocean is. So you can actually put a freshwater cap on top of the ocean, and that has all sorts of implications for not just the circulation, but also for all levels of the food web, from tiny plants and animals, what we call plankton, and then everything that feeds on those plankton all the way up. So fish to whales to seals, the amount of freshwater and the timing of that fresh water really matter to these ecosystems.
So, and then back in the other direction, I mean, I thinking in terms of fresh water and estuary and ocean, but come from the other direction, as ocean chemistry itself seems to change with acidity, for example, what effects do you notice in the estuary?
Right, and that's one of the big questions we've been looking at in Coos Bay, is there's been this observation on the Oregon coast, on the continental shelf, that hypoxia, which is the low levels of oxygen, these hypoxic events have been increasing every summer for the past 10 years or so. And one of the big questions we asked was, well, is that low oxygen water getting into the estuaries? And it turns out in Coos Bay, the answer is probably no. But in other estuaries, the answer is probably yes, and it really depends on where you are along the Oregon coast. It turns out to be a more complicated question than we first thought, in that the levels of a hypoxia, or low, dangerously low dissolved oxygen on the shelf, actually change wherever you are on the Oregon coast. They're not equal along the whole coast, so it really depends on where you are along the coast, whether or not you're going to see that signal enter into the estuary.
David, what do you know about how humans treat estuaries now and wetlands generally? We've had, protection for wetlands for a long time now, but I wonder if that extends to estuaries and if there are efforts afoot to restore places where fresh and salt water meet, to make them better than they've been for a while.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think this is what makes studying estuaries so interesting and important, is that it is where humans live. It's not studying climate change happening in the middle of the Arctic or places in the middle of the ocean. It's actually it's places where most of the U.S. population, a lot of the U.S. population lives, near estuaries. In Coos Bay, for example, Coos County is updating their estuarine management plan right now. What that means is they're redefining all different zones in the estuary, thinking about wetlands and seagrass beds and mudflats and areas where there's an industry or areas where they can, where shellfish farms can be. And so I think there's a big effort underfoot right now to to re-examine this management plan. It hasn't been updated since 1970, so it's going to be a new, fresh look at what's happening in Coos Bay, and we'll really try to think about the impact that humans have had on Coos Bay and try to be predictive and proactive about what, you know, the uses and, uses in terms of development, but also conservation and natural resource uses.
There could be some real surprises along the way, though, a little further south in Bandon. I'm sure you've noticed the marshlands and the mosquito issues they've had there.
Right, yes. Yeah, so every estuary is a little bit different. And it's nice that in Coos Bay, for example, there's such a big group of interested stakeholders and committed groups there, you know, everywhere from the South Slough National Estuarine Reserve to local tribes, to the Coos Watershed Association. There's a really great group of stakeholders all working on trying to, you know, monitor the estuary, think about its health, and think about how we optimize the different uses that people have for the estuary.
Okay, so a fair amount of interest in looking a little more closely at the areas that we took for granted for a long time and abused, it sounds like, too.
Right.
All right, Dr. David Sutherland is a coastal physical oceanographer. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Oregon, and he'll be speaking on Friday night at 7 at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay about the estuary at Coos Bay. In fact, it's called Estuary Circulation, and it's linked to water quality in Coos Bay. He'll also have a few things to say, I'm sure, about higher latitude areas like Greenland as well. David Sutherland, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, take care.